Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast and audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within 1 square mile of the West End. Today's episode is about Brian Alexander Robinson, a 19-year-old part-time DJ who murdered a man he had never met before, for no financial gain nor personal malice. And yet, although he was found guilty, Brian should never have been tried for murder. Murder Mile contains grisly details, which may upset the Fluffy Bunny Brigade, as well as realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. This is Murder Mile. Episode 34, Brian Alexander Robinson and the D'Arblay Street Death. Today, I'm standing on D'Arblay Street, smack bang in Soho Centre, two streets west of the murder scene of Canadian masturbator Richard Rhodes Henley, one street north of the Blackout Ripper's second victim, Evelyn Oakley, and one street northeast of sweet-natured sex worker Ginger Ray. Speckled with a messy mix of 80s eyesores, 60s shit pits, and 18th century slum houses, although D'Arblay Street is curiously quiet, bafflingly broken, and painfully pug-ugly, owing to a teeny tiny little hole in the road, which, even after 1.5 years, Westminster Council still hasn't fixed. After a sizable injection of cash, this stumpy little side street is finally being given a second lease of life. As, yes, you've guessed it, yet another haven for half-witted hipsters. Ugh. And although, like a hipster's head, it's always half empty, except for vague hints of hummus and falafel, the unsubtle sounds of bongos and didgeridoos, and the sight of top-hatted twats supping micro-brewed beers made from liberated lentils, terrapin tears, and ethically sourced breast milk, if your idea of heaven is having a hat so tiny it looks like a boil on your bonce, jeans so tight that the world knows your religion, or a mush so hideously hairy it resembles an unkempt sailor's anus, yes, Marco, I mean you, give it a year, and D'Arblay Street may become your very own personal paradise. And yet, today, on the south side of D'Arblay Street, by the dark and brooding archway of Wardour Mews, where a long line of overexcited and easily duped tourists queue up for 2 to 3 hours, simply so they can say that they've sat in a very specific, if underwhelming, cafe. It was right here that Brian Robinson was forced to make a decision which would change two lives forever. On the 22nd of June 1948, a British troop carrier docked in the Essex port of Tilbury, having first made a detour to Kingston, Jamaica. On board were 802 servicemen from the Commonwealth colony of the West Indies, who, as loyal subjects to His Majesty the King, had bravely fought in the Second World War. And now, with Britain in an economic depression and suffering a severe labour shortage, these brave men were once again coming to our aid. But not as warriors, as workers. The ship would be known as the Windrush, and for many, it marked the birth of modern multiculturalism in Britain. Having left behind their families, their homes, and their lives, upon arrival at Tilbury Dock, with many men clutching a single suitcase, wearing their one good suit, a pork pie hat, and a confused look as they wondered who stole the sun, hid all the fruit, covered everything in concrete, and whittled in the water. Some men stayed for a few years, but most remained, later followed by their families. And as immigration continued through the 1950s, by the mid-1960s, with the West Indian workers rarely, if ever, being thanked and habitually being branded as the bogeyman by the uneducated whites, and even by Britain's other immigrants who'd quickly forgotten their own hardship and had adopted a we-were-here-first attitude to the new invaders. Britain in the 1960s was a powder keg of racial tension. Sparked by right-wing fascists such as Oswald Mosley's union movement, who fought to keep Britain white, inflamed by British Prime Minister Sir David Lloyd George, who referred to Jamaica as the slum of the empire, and fanned by a government who saw the West Indian emigres no longer as help, but as a hindrance, and not as a people, but as a problem. Almost a decade before the 1976 Race Relations Act, which made it illegal to refuse homes, jobs, or services to anyone based on their ethnic heritage, it must have seemed like lunacy for any West Indian to want to come to Britain. But on the 16th of August, 1961, a 16-year-old boy did just that. And his name was Brian Robinson. Brian Alexander Robinson was born on the 11th of November 1944 in the Jamaican capital of Kingston. With stout little legs, podgy round cheeks, and a pot belly, Brian was the firstborn son of two doting parents, Mary and Alexander. He was healthy, happy, loved, and he would also be their last. When Brian was just 1 year old, his father died of cancer, leaving his distraught mother in the grip of depression. Being desperate for her attention, Brian became hyperactive and hot-tempered. But with him being the spitting image of her dear departed husband, his love went unreturned. Age 7, being eager to be seen rather than smacked. Whilst playing in the garden, Brian fell from a tree. And yet, as much as he screamed, cried, and clutched his arm, with his mother having remarried, and busy cuddling her new baby boy. Neither Brian nor his injured arm received the attention they so badly needed. With his left humerus fractured, chronic inflammation having set in, and with the bone going untreated, as Brian grew, his left arm didn't, and the pain would plague him for the rest of his life. Age 9, Brian's mother uprooted with her new family to Brooklyn, New York, leaving her firstborn son behind in Kingston, the responsibility of relatives. Although studious, if a little easily upset, Brian studied hard at the St. Alison School and later at Grove College. But being of below average intelligence and gaining no qualifications, aged just 16, Brian left the sunshine behind to seek a better life in Britain. On the 16th of August 1961, a 5 foot, 5 inch man with square shoulders, an ambling gait, and a little pot belly strutted down the gangplank at Southampton Dock, his broad plump face beaming. As unlike the land he'd left behind, there was no sun, trees, or sky. Just a noisy cacophony of ships, trains, cars, and cranes, as the air hung thick with smog. In his right hand, Brian held a small battered suitcase, and in his left hand, a hat, the arm of his brown suit having been restitched a few inches shorter. Like most West Indians, raised on a diet of fruits, meats, vegetables, and spice, the British cuisine was, at best, disappointing, and at worst, disgusting. A bland, tepid, overboiled mush made from animal entrails, topped with an unpalatable pastry, and to combat its blandness, it would be slathered in salt, coated in ketchup, or drowned in gravy. But for Brian, this was a symbol of his new life. Sadly, 13 years after the first arrivals on the Windrush, the tide had turned. And with the West Indian emigres, who'd been invited to help rebuild Britain, now regarded by a thankless state as a burden, even highly skilled workers struggled to find jobs, with doctors working as dishwashers, barristers as brickies, and office clerks as cleaners. And being forced to live in slum housing, their rights ignored, and faced with a barrage of threats, hostility, and violence, life for British West Indians was tough. Having moved into a first-floor flat at No. 9 Elm Park in the West Indian enclave of Brixton, South London. Although Brian briefly worked as a warehouseman and his work record was regarded as satisfactory, being easily riled, highly strung and hot-tempered, each job rarely lasted more than a few months. And always feeling like a stranger in a strange land, what Brian craved most for was family. Being hungry, desperate, and broke, on the 28th of December 1962, Brian was fined 20 shillings for the theft of one loaf, four rolls, and 3 pints of milk. On the 17th of January 1963, he was sentenced to 3 months in prison for handling forged money. And on the 18th of January 1964, he served 5 months for obtaining a stolen checkbook. And although he was hardly a career criminal. Being a black man with a prison record in 1960s Britain, Brian struggled to find employment, and after an endless slog of mind-numbing jobs, as a shop assistant, a radio repairman, and a laundry worker, in June 1964, Brian started work as a part-time DJ at the Limbo Club. 6 weeks later, he would be charged with murder. Today, down the dark and brooding archway of Wardour Mews, just off D'Arblay Street, hidden in the basement of number 11B, is DM Buttons, a bespoke embroiderer's which monograms and personalises buttons for most of the exclusive tailors on Savile Row. But back in 1964, this was the Limbo Club. With the eastern side of Wardour Mews having been bombed during the Blitz of World War II, this thin, dark, Edwardian dead end was once a no-go zone for any sensible citizen, being packed, as it was, with derelict buildings, burnt-out cars and broken glass. But amongst the debris, a series of illegal gambling dens, brothels, coffee houses and nightclubs sprung up. Hidden in the damp dark squalor of the rat-infested basement at 11B Wardour Mews, the Limbo Club was an illegal nightclub, notorious for its raids and run-ins with the police, frequent fights, racial tension, and was predominantly frequented by black men keen to dance with white women, and vice versa. Being barely 60 feet wide and 40 feet deep, with a low-slung ceiling, the Limbo Club was lined with threadbare benches along the bare-peeling walls, with a brick staircase at one end, a badly painted mural of a Tuscan vineyard at the other, as well as a fag machine, a few lights, and a bar in the middle, which served bottled beers and spirits. It was grubby, grimy, and grim. But for Brian, it was home. Perched in the corner cubbyhole, right next to the brick stairs, with a hi-fi system, a vinyl turntable, a wooden chair, and two stereo speakers, each evening, as the resident DJ, Brian spun a soulful mix of rocksteady, reggae, and ska records, including Bob Marley and the Wailers, Toots and the Maytals, Prince Buster, Desmond Dekker and the Aces, Lord Tanamo and the Scatterlights. And with many of the West Indian regulars drinking rum, smoking weed, and chatting in a thick patois, although the Limbo Club was in a dingy basement in a bombed-out London slum, for Brian, it was a little piece of heaven. Ran by his best friend, Oliver, whose real name was Leon Winchester Williams, Oliver was a 26-year-old thin-faced rasta with high cheekbones, tight dreads, a goatee beard, and a thick Jamaican accent, who, being a few years older and a few inches taller, Brian regarded as the brother he never had. And with the Limbo Club being where Brian had met his 18-year-old girlfriend, Jacqueline Edwards, known as Jackie, a white girl from a Catholic family who he planned to marry the following year, this wasn't just a nightclub. This was his home and his family. And he would do anything to protect them. On the evening of Thursday, the 28th of August, 1964, one night before the murder, Brian, who was liked by everyone and had no known enemies, was DJing in the corner cubbyhole. Sat near him on one of the threadbare benches was a large, white, ape-like bruiser from Deptford, known as Big Jim. All knuckles, muscles, and menace. His tree trunk-like legs spread wide like he owned the place, and a rough scowl on his gormless face as he necked back one too many beers. Having stood up and stooped to pick up a fallen vinyl record, Big Jim popped his paint-splattered boot on Brian's chair. Being polite, Brian asked, "Excuse me, sorry, can I have my chair?" As this thin wooden chair wasn't just somewhere for Brian to park his bum, but with his fractured arm, often causing him pain in the cold as well as the heat, Brian needed a place to rest it. But Big Jim grunted, "No." Maybe Big Jim was genuinely tired. Maybe, like Brian, he was physically disabled. Or maybe, as a racist, Big Jim simply disliked a black man forcing black music into his white ears. But having politely asked twice, Brian shoved Big Jim's foot and took the seat back. Without provocation, Big Jim pulled a flick knife and drunkenly slashed at Brian's torso, but missed and sliced a small hole in his jacket. Enraged, Big Jim yanked the seat back, tossing the 5'5" black youth onto the floor. And as the white brute stood there, nostrils flared and knuckles gripped, towering over the small, chubby and physically disabled teen, with the shimmering blade of his flick knife bared, Big Jim struck again. Suddenly, all Big Jim saw was bricks, as his snarling face was pinned to the wall by Eddie Kayser, the club's burly bouncer, who disarmed him in an armlock. And as Big Jim yelled and frothed like a rabid dog, fearing a bloody aftermath, as Eddie held back the drunken lout, Oliver told Brian to run. They'd had trouble in the Limbo Club before, not just because it was a club for black men, run by black men, and frequented by black men who danced with white women, and vice versa, but because the Teddy Boys were always looking for a fight. And as senseless as it was, that's how it started. Friday the 29th of August 1964 was hot and sticky, as a summer sun burned through the cloudless sky. For Brian, the heat and humidity was a welcome reminder of his Jamaican roots, as he sat, shirtless, on the sofa with Jackie, kissing and cuddling with the woman he loved. And as much as their lips lingered, little did they know that this would be the last kiss they would ever share. At roughly 9 p.m, as the sun slowly set over the London skyline, his best buddy, Oliver, accompanied by his new girlfriend, Evelyn, a feisty Irish redhead who he'd met at the club just a few weeks before, called at Brian's first floor flat at number 9 Elm Park in Brixton. This was part of their usual routine. As they fixed some cold drinks, Oliver cautioned his mate that word on the street was that Big Jim would be back. Being no dummy, Brian knew this. And as much as he knew that a short tubby cripple didn't stand a chance against a 6-foot oaf with a flick knife, he knew he needed to even the odds. From inside his jacket, Brian pulled a knife. Not a small knife, like the pathetic fish slice that Big Jim had drunkenly waved about, like a furious prude wafting away an unpleasant fart. But a real knife. with a thick steel blade, 2 inches wide by 9 inches long. Oliver's wide eyes said it all. It truly was a terrifying piece. But that was the point. Brian wasn't an idiot. He knew he was too crippled to fight, too small to run, and he had no experience of knives whatsoever. So when Big Jim saw the big knife, it would be less of a lethal killing machine and more of a terrifying threat. Again, Oliver warned Brian not to carry the knife. But his mind was made up. What if Big Jim attacked him? What if Big Jim attacked Oliver, Evelyn, or Jackie? These weren't just his friends. This was his family. And as a young boy with no real next of kin, these were the people he loved. At 10 p.m., Oliver, Jackie, Evelyn, and Brian, who was dressed in a blue corduroy jacket, a crisp white shirt, and blue jeans, caught the number 50 bus from Brixton to Charing Cross Road and headed into Soho.
Hail Jarastafara!
Although the sweltering sun had turned the Limbo Club into a stinking skunk pit, as with having no windows, one door, and being based in a damp basement, the fetid stench of sweat, smoke, and spilt spirits made the smell unbearable as the overheated patrons swigged back warm beers. With Big Jim nowhere to be seen, Brian's seat staying under his bum, and Oliver grooving with Evelyn on the dance floor as Brian needle-dropped from ska track to reggae funk, apart from the usual blokey banter and argy-bargy from the local lads letting off steam, by all accounts, the night was uneventful. In fact, the only fracas which preceded the murder was an unrecorded bit of verbal abuse between one group of local teddy boys, all of whom were white. For whatever reason, a labourer called Peter Richardson Smith took umbrage with five local lads stood by the brick stairs. They were Johnny Howard, Victor Lazenby, Terry Marshall, Terry Kelly, Johnny's younger brother David, and Caroline Fisher, mother to Johnny's four-month-old baby daughter. But as fast as it flared up, the fury fizzled out. And shortly afterwards, the lads left. It was just a regular night. By 2 a.m., with the hijinks over and everyone dancing, the 9-inch knife that Brian had stashed by his decks, ready to grab should Big Jim come cruising for a bruising, it seemed pretty pointless. But the night was about to turn bad. And that knife would change two lives forever. Moments later, Oliver burst down the brick stairs, shouting, "Brian, they're here!" And having barged past the bulk of Eddie the Bouncer, he hastily dashed into the bombed-out mess of Wardour Mews. His swift exit followed by a series of deafening thuds, smashed glass, and muffled screams. Eager to eavesdrop on the ensuing melee, the club's patrons surged forward, causing a bottleneck of sweaty bodies on the stairs. And being keen to keep the chaos outside, Eddie bolted the door shut. Outside, a volley of hurled house bricks and broken beer bottles bounced off the steel-reinforced door, as a brutal cacophony of yells and screams echoed. As inside, Brian shouted, "Let me out! Oliver's out there!" fearful of the unimaginable horror his best friend was facing as the missiles rained down. But the intended target was neither Oliver nor Brian. Seeing a snarling gang of angry white youths, armed with bricks and bottles, Oliver thought these were Big Jim's boys sent to bust Brian up. But huddled by the door, on the floor, he saw the bloody mess of Peter Richardson Smith, the labourer who'd had a brief verbal outburst with the local lads just moments before. And as Oliver had exited the club, he'd accidentally been caught in the crossfire. Of course, Brian didn't see any of this. As the hail of homemade missiles died down, and the fiery Jamaican forced his way out of the limbo club into the derelict bombsite of Wardour Mews, he didn't see Peter Richardson Smith. He didn't see anything. All he saw was Oliver, his friend, his brother, and his family, slumped in a sea of scattered debris, as pouring from his head was a steady stream of blood. Furiously, Brian demanded, "Who did this?" And with a groggy, trembling hand, Oliver said, "Those white boys!" and pointed to a group of snarling yobs, dashing up the dark and brooding archway and out into Darblay Street. Seeing red as his seething blood boiled, as Brian charged at Wardour Mews, hurling a volley of abuse and bottles, as he dashed into the bright lights of Darblay Street, he very quickly realised his mistake. As being stood, smack bang in the middle of the street, alone and exposed, Brian was surrounded by those 14 white men, all armed, drunk, and angry, as they slowly circled him. Most of whom had been in the club that night. One of whom was 25-year-old local teddy boy, Johnny Howard. As far as we know, neither Brian nor Johnny had ever met, talked, or fought before. They were just two total strangers who'd come face to face. One was black, one was white, but both were hot-tempered. Still steaming, having seen his best friend battered with bricks, fearing for the safety of his wife-to-be, Jackie, and believing that Big Jim had sent these angry white yobs to kill him. Combined with a lethal mix of this being a racially volatile period in 1960s London, Brian being a Jamaican Rasta, Johnny being a British teddy boy, and Jackie being Brian's white girlfriend, add into the mix alcohol and aggression. That is all the moment took. Being terrified, tiny, and outnumbered, Brian pulled from his blue corduroy jacket the oversized knife that he'd hidden by the hi-fi should Big Jim return. Although a threatening piece, now the realization of Oliver's words hit home. He was right. With Brian being short, crippled, and not a born fighter, he had no idea how to use the knife. And looking like a frightened zebra about to be pounced on by a wild pack of hungry hyenas, being desperate to escape, Brian began swinging and slashing indiscriminately with the sharp 9-inch piece of steel. Most of which missed, until one of them hit. Johnny Howard was stabbed just below his right nipple, the sharp blade piercing his crisp white shirt and khaki cardigan, sinking 4 inches long and 3 inches deep into his chest, skewering his left lung, severing his aorta, and splitting his main artery. Johnny didn't stand a chance. As Brian and Jackie fled, having dived into a taxi on nearby Wardour Street, they didn't see the horror unfolding behind them. As with steady spurts of hot red blood squirting from his severed heart, Johnny staggered towards his friend's car. But having stumbled barely 50 feet, he suddenly stopped. And just shy of Berwick Street, he said, "I've had it," and died in the street. He was 25 years old and left behind a 4-month-old baby daughter. Brian was arrested in his first floor flat at number 9 Elm Park in Brixton just a few hours later, as he lay asleep with his girlfriend Jackie. Sitting on the bed, dressed in nothing but a pair of pants and a white vest, Brian professed his innocence, knowing his friends would back him up. With the trial being held at the Old Bailey on the 13th of October 1964, less than 6 weeks later, with much of the eyewitness testimonies either being conflicted, convoluted, or statements by hardly credible witnesses who at the time of the murder were either biased, drunk, or drugged, even with the 9-inch knife and his bloody shirt being found in his flat, Brian pleaded not guilty. But having been implicated in the crime and fearful of receiving a lengthy prison sentence, one person colluded with the police, became the star witness for the prosecution, and testified that Brian alone was the murderer. It was his best friend, Oliver. At his trial, an exasperated Brian stated, "What a friend. He gets up in the box and says he saw me do it. When I get out, I'm never going to help anyone ever again." A few months later, just as he was starting a life term in prison, Jackie dumped him. Brian Alexander Robinson, the 19-year-old Jamaican youth, with a deceased father, an absent mother, and a disabled arm, who'd travelled from the sun-kissed isles of the West Indies into the English gloom and racial turbulence of the early 1960s to seek a better life, a steady job, and, he hoped, a family, spent the next 15 years of his life trapped in a cold grey cell in Brixton Prison, with no sunlight, no music, no love, and no chance of acquittal or an early release. And as a black man in 1960s Britain, who went to rescue his friend, who was set upon by an angry mob of white men, and who feared for his life, Brian appealed his life sentence on the 24th of May 1965, reasonably stating that he was threatened, provoked, and rightfully, he pleaded self-defense. His appeal was denied. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. Stay tuned to Extra Mile after the break. A big thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who get exclusive access to lots of secret, and often rather sexy, Murder Mile stuff, as well as a personal thank you from me. They are Lara Ingbo's daughter, JJ, Stevie P, Mark Robotham, the mysterious one, and my lovely Eva. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello? 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 Welcome, listeners. Welcome to Extra Mile. If you're new, this is Extra Mile. This is the unscripted bit. Unscripted. Lots of mistakes. No music. No sound effects. None of that. This is all just me talking to you about the case that we've just discussed. There's some other stuff thrown in there as well, but it's not edited. Lots of stuff that would normally get taken out, but me, no. In this section, the first bit is very, very scripted. It takes about 60 hours a week to create all that, to do all the sounds, and it's very, you know, I spend hours going through every single sound to make it perfect. This bit, this is as it is, entirely unedited. So, episode 2. I thought I'd give you something different from last time. Last time was obviously the Tratsett family, about a mentally unwell man who murdered his family. This time I thought I'd go for something a little bit different. This was more... The reason why I like this story is it is kind of a... you know, it could happen to any of us. This is not... He's not a murderer. He's not a gangland killer. He's not a drug dealer. He's not, you know, he's not a bad person at all. He's just a young lad who's just looking for someone to love. He hasn't had a lot of love in his life, and he's not bad. He's just doing his thing, and he's trying to survive in kind of a difficult situation in a difficult era as well. And he made a small mistake actually by buying that knife. He really shouldn't have bought the knife at all, but he did. And that's what I love about this story, is it could happen to anyone. It really could. He made a stupid mistake. He caused a death. He ended up in prison. Where he is now, we really don't know. He would have been released from prison in 1981. It would have been 15 years before he served, before he got parole. But I can't find a death certificate for him. I don't know whether he left and went back to Jamaica. He would have been a British citizen. He would have been nationalised. And whether he stayed here, I don't know. So he was born in 1944. So what would he be now? He'd be, what, 70s? Hang on, no. No, he'd probably be mid-70s, yeah. So, yeah, probably still around. I thought that was quite a topical story, especially with everything that's going on in Britain at the moment with the Windrush generation. If you're not British and you probably haven't heard of this story, obviously, as I mentioned at the start, there were loads of West Indian people who were brought over here after World War II. We had a real shortage of people. So many people have been murdered by the bombings or killed in war. So we needed a lot of people to help rebuild the country. The government at the time said, oh, well, you know, we've got all these people who served for us in the West Indies, let's bring them over here as workers. And it was like, oh, fantastic, they're going to come over here and, you know, help us all. But if you look at the press reports, all this great footage of all these West Indian people coming over into Britain to help us, but very quickly that turned. It's like, firstly, they weren't given a lot of help. There's a lot of footage of a lot of the West Indian people coming off the boat at Tilbury. And then they had to spend the first part of their stay in Britain inside an old air raid shelter, basically in Clapham South, in the underground. There was no light, there was no air, they were given really shitty food, they had very little. And then after that, they were just treated really badly. The West Indian people were not treated as the heroes coming over here to help us. They were treated by everyone, not just by the British people, but also by other immigrants who'd already been here, who'd, as I said, had got adopted a "we were here first" attitude, which, let's be honest, that happens a lot. That people, even in our country, like I'm sure my history goes back to, I mean, we've traced it back to about the 6th century or something like that in Britain, but I can't say that I'm 100% British. Do you know, there's probably some Saxon in there. There's probably a big chunk of African. We all come from Africa, really, let's be honest, don't we? So we're all immigrants, but obviously we all forget that, don't we? So, but what's happening at the moment in Britain is that a lot of West Indians who came over in the 1940s, 1950s, they had become British citizens. Many didn't get passports because, you know, if you're not going to go overseas, you really don't need one. And it's got to the point, unfortunately, that the government has turned around and said, OK, we're rescinding your UK status. And it's like, but hang on, we're British citizens. It's like, well, technically you're not. So the real shit pile going on at the moment with the British government, just really... Oh, being arseholes. And obviously this story has been trumped by Donald Trump and his Mexican baby prison, which hasn't helped at all. So that's probably why, if you're not in Britain, you probably haven't heard of this story. But this story, interestingly, so how did I discover it? It was gut instinct, weirdly. Now, I've mentioned this on social media before. I'm not psychic in any way. I don't believe in any of that kind of twaddle. I'm a real fact-based person, but every Sunday on my walk, I do a, if you've been on my walk, you know, I do a story, about a guy who murdered his wife and his family. They basically ran a tobacconist. It's on Wardour Street, and you'll recognize it because it's a building with like a skull on top of it with a dagger sticking out the top. And every time I stand there, I always look at Wardour Mews. And I always think, I get a weird feeling that something bad has happened there. And I don't believe in this kind of stuff. It's just, you know, it's just a gut reaction. So I started doing research. I started going to the National Archives and looking for murders in D'Arblay Street. And then I checked Wardour Mews. And that's when it popped up. I thought it was too small to find murders in there. But there was a murder. So it was this one. And yeah, it was just interesting to find it. But every time I stopped there, I always got a weird feeling that a murder had gone on. Started reading it, really enjoyed it as a murder case. Obviously, it's not about serial killers or demented people. This is what I like. It's a personal story about real people pushed to the edge. Brian's not a killer at all. But... a black man surrounded by 14 white men, all angry, all drunk, all with broken bottles. You know, what would you do? What would you do if you were surrounded by lots of angry people who hated you? And, you know, if you got a knife on you, would you use it? Probably. By the look of it, what he was saying is he was waving it around. There's another part to the story as well that I didn't put in there. This story is very convoluted, so I've had to write it as Brian's story. Because that's the only way to try and tell it in a way that makes sense. But there were pieces where Brian said he was hit with a brick and he was slightly dizzy. This was when he went out of the club and he found Oliver. He was dizzy and he had blood in his eyes. But although there was a slight graze on his head, the doctor said it wasn't enough to bleed. So I haven't really put that part of the story in, but Brian had said that he was slashing away with a knife because he couldn't see. Do you know, it was dark outside, he'd got blood in his eyes. Whether that really happened, I don't know. It's a real nightmare to try and work out what really happened that night. As I said in the story, there's lots of conflicting reports, and I've gone through all of the reports and all of them conflict. In fact, some people have given multiple statements, and all of those reports conflict. It's hard to work out exactly what happened. One of the things that was hard at the start originally was to find the bloody Limbo Club. This is one of the things that, again, on the police report, they wrote, we went to Wardour Mews, we went to the Limbo Club. But again, no one puts down the number, and it's really frustrating. And I don't know why such a simple thing is so hard to put on a report. It's like if I was going to say someone was murdered, say at your house, and you go, it's 26 Acacia Road. I wouldn't just write murderer Acacia Road. I'd write 26 Acacia Road because that's the murder location, not the road itself. Unless it was outside a specific building, then you'd say it's outside number 15 Acacia Road. But here on none of the reports did they write down where the Limbo Club was. I was digging through the history of the Limbo Club. I had to go through a lot of it was really in a history of reggae in the 1960s, where it was mentioned that it was now, that it was at 11B. And then I went to 11B and then I found out it was DM Buttons, which is really interesting. And actually on the DM Buttons website, they have some little pictures on there of the Limbo Club in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Because it was a club before that. It was always owned by Italians. Hence the awful picture of a Tuscan skyline in there that they never moved. The Jamaicans, when they took it over, they never thought, let's put in a nice picture of Jamaica. They were just like, yeah, let's stick with Tuscany. Yeah, of course, why not? So DM Buttons is still there today. Still the original building. Even though most of the area was bombed by the huge bomb in 1941, I believe it was, blasted out the eastern end of it. The western end of it is still original. And it's still today, if you go, we walk down there, it's tight, it's a wardrobe. It's got the old kind of little Victorian lights, the ones that you kind of always picture like on old TV series and things like that. That's all still there, so it all looks original. So, but I've posted a video of this on my social media, so you can have a look at that and see what it actually looks like at the moment. But as I said, this is a story of so many sides. It really is. So I've told Brian's story, but see, it's hard to define everything. So, because everyone had their own perspectives that night. So I could have done this from John Howard's story. So Johnny Howard, the guy who was stabbed. I thought about that, doing that at the start. I really did. I really thought to myself, well, he's the victim. And you know I love writing the stories about victims rather than the killers. I thought, let's sit down and write Johnny Howard's story. But the problem is, as I went through all of the stories and statements from his friends who were there that night, and his girlfriend, she gave multiple statements, and each of them changed wildly each time. And the problem is, even people who were there, like some of the people who were there, it was hard to write their story, because when you read their statements, it really was a capsule of the racial tensions at the time. So they would say, my mate Terry did this, my mate Terry did that. And then, I apologise for my language here, but this is basically what it said. Then the statement would say, then this nigger did this, then that coon did that. And it was like, I couldn't write their story. I probably could if I was going to write a story where I'd go, there was these ignorant fuckwits who are just racist and they're just ignorant, and I was just like, I could have wrote that one, but I just didn't want to. But when I started reading Brian's story, that kind of got me, because it's like, you know, a killer by mistake, unwilling, his mum left him, his dad died, he had a disabled arm, came to Britain to make a nice life for himself. It didn't go as planned. And he struggled through adversity. And, that made me want to side with his story more. So if you were to go through, you could go through this case again and write it in a variety of different ways, because all of the statements conflict. In some of the statements, like I've written it that Oliver said, "Brian, they're here," and then he came upstairs and there were white boys throwing bottles and bricks at Oliver and Peter Richardson Smith. But there are other statements that say when Peter Richardson Smith went upstairs first and when he got attacked, there were black boys throwing bottles and bricks. What way am I going with this? So Peter Richardson Smith went upstairs outside the Limbo Club and there were black boys throwing bottles at him, and then they ran off. And then Brian came out and saw some white boys. It all got confusing about who was attacking who. There was like one lot of black boys, one lot of white boys, another lot of black boys. It all got mixed. People running in different areas. So every single different statement was all over the shop. Even trying to explain it to you now is a nightmare. Because some people just didn't see other people. As I was going through the list, so Brian was hit first. And then it was like, hang on, what's this? No, Brian wasn't hit first. Peter was hit first. So it was kind of, so originally I thought it was black men throwing bottles at a white man, which is Peter, and then Oliver trying to break it up. But it wasn't. What it seemed to be was white boys throwing bottles at a white man and a black man accidentally got involved. So what started as a kind of a racial tension story actually was some kind of argument between Peter and Johnny Howard inside the club, of which we have no idea what they said, because no one relayed back what it was in any of the statements at all. And then for some reason they had an argument and it fell into a fight, and then Oliver got involved, and therefore Brian got involved. It's really confusing. That's why I've tried to write this as clearly as possible. So I'm more inclined to believe Brian's story, because a lot of the white people's statements, quite racist. We still have no idea what was the argument between Peter Richardson and Johnny, and why. See, that's the other thing that's difficult as well. It's clear why Brian goes after the white boys, because he sees his friend, his brother, attacked, hit with a bottle, and he dashes up Wardour Street to D'Arblay Street to chase them. Now Brian actually says that because he couldn't get back into the club because Eddie had locked the door, he was going out that way to get a phone to call the police. Although a lot of statements say that by the point he was already running out that way with a knife in his hand. Some people say he had, some people say he hadn't got a knife in his hand. Some people say Johnny's girlfriend said that Brian had stabbed Johnny with a broken bottle. But the autopsy entirely went against that. And it's a really confusing story because everyone says that people are wearing different coloured clothes, which is why I referenced at the start what colour clothes people are wearing, because throughout people are going, someone's wearing red, this person's wearing white, this person's wearing blue, and it's really confusing. There was a lot of racial tension in there. Why the Teddy Boys and Johnny Howard, when they circled Brian, why it all kicked off then, whether it was a racist thing, whether Brian had said something, we don't know, whether Johnny had said something, we don't know. Whether they'd had a bit of a to-do in the club previously, we don't know that either. It's said that they didn't, but maybe they did. So there's a lot of gaps in this story. And this is what made the case really difficult for the police, is that when you've got 20 to 30 different people all giving different stories, who are you going to believe? Basically, they just had to go with what they knew, which was that they had the knife, it had some fingerprints on it, it had blood on it, they found a shirt. They had their star witness, so they had to charge him that way. But there was always a lot of tension in the Limbo Club, because this was, just like the Shim Sham Club, which is also on Wardour Street, back in the 30s, the Limbo Club was a place where black men could come and listen to black music but dance with white women. And in the 1960s, this was really frowned upon thing by society, but kind of, if you were... if you're a racist, you would go searching for that kind of thing to beat people up. And that's why you get a lot of teddy boys. I'm not saying that all teddy boys were like that, but in this case, these were teddy boys. This is why you would see them go into clubs like that, because they wanted to get drunk and they wanted to cause trouble. And there's always had been a lot of bad blood in the club, lots of racial tensions. So, what happened there is a real nightmare. It's absolutely difficult to confirm what happened. Okay, Big Jim. So that's probably where you thought the story was going, that Big Jim would turn up and there would be a fight between Big Jim and Brian. I thought that as well. Going through all the records, I thought that Big Jim, having placed his foot on Brian's chair, and then, there was the fight and Big Jim pulls out his flick knife, but then gets stopped by Eddie. I thought that's where the story would go, but Big Jim doesn't come back. And I've gone through all of the witness statements, and it's only Brian who mentions Big Jim, who apparently his real name is Charles. God, this story is confusing. There's so many people who have, like Oliver. Oliver's real name is Leon, but they call him Oliver. Bloody hell. Why can't people just have proper nicknames? Like, someone called James is called Jim, as opposed to someone called Charles is called Big Jim. Ugh. Anyway, Big Jim only appears in Brian's statement. He doesn't appear in any other statement. No one else can clarify that this happened. And for some reason, even on the witness statement with Eddie Kaysen, the doorman, the police didn't query whether this thing had happened with Big Jim the night before. It's not on any of his witness statements, which I would have thought that's one of the first things you do, is check that this story was real. So it's only Brian who mentions Big Jim. So whether this actually happened or not, or whether this was a fabrication added to the story, we really don't know. We don't know at all. What happened to Brian after he was sent to prison for 15 years? Well, he was given a life sentence, which is 15 years without parole. If he managed to get parole, he would have been out in 1979. But where he is now, we really don't know. Could be anywhere. Could be in Britain. Could be in Jamaica. Could still be in prison. Don't know. Maybe he only served a couple of years. But I can't find any record of him at all, which is not to say he's a great mystery. It's just to say that just the details aren't there. A lot of the details of people still living are really hard to find. If people are dead and they've been dead for years, it's great, but if people are still living, it's an absolute nightmare to track down. So the Limbo Club was always a dodgy club, always had been. I managed to get some extra details from thanks to Septic Peg. I was having a peruse through your website. I hope you don't mind. I know you sent me the link, so I always have a look through it. And you've got some good details on the Limbo Club there. So, 1977, about 13 years after that, a guy called Harold Bidney ran the Limbo Club. And he was convicted of being a paedophile. Who else? David Gordon was around the same time, was a doorman of the Limbo Club, charged with stabbing John Joseph Wall, who was a doctor's receptionist. I'm going to look into that, because if we can have another club, another murder in the Limbo Club, that'd be interesting for season 3. And also Stephen John Hartford was charged with providing Purple Hearts, obviously hallucinogenic drugs, in the 1960s. So this was 1965. This was the year after the murder. So it had all moved on from that point. Now, there were other things in the story that I haven't added in. there was a couple of statements about Oliver being a pimp. So I said that he had his girlfriend Evelyn. There is discussions in there that the Limbo Club, not only was it just a nightclub for kind of dancing and getting a bit stoned and, you know, black men dancing with white women, but there is discussions in the witness statements, which I can't corroborate at all, that Oliver was a pimp and that he used to pimp out a lot of white women to black men. Now, one of these women, in her statement, it was actually from Evelyn, his latest girlfriend. I've put down girlfriend, but whether they were kind of seeing each other, we're not too sure. But it looked as if he was trying to pimp her out. So Oliver has a bit of a darker history. So you can probably understand why, for him, he would probably want to collude with the police and say, this is what happened, aren't I being good? Because then they can probably let him off with other crimes that he'd committed, such as the police probably turned around and said, we're going to charge you with manslaughter and racketeering and prostitution. And he could turn around and go, look, if I tell you who committed the murder, I give you all the details, can you let me off with a lesser offence than prostitution? So that could have happened. I'm not actually too sure, but that's the details that seem to be in there. Whew. So I hope you enjoyed that. That was Brian Alexander Robinson. Next week it will be an entirely different story. I'm not announcing what they are in advance because I'm kind of working it out as I go along. I'm trying to find different stories. Coot update, if you want coot update. New family of coots outside. The coots are growing up very nicely. Another set of coots who have already had kids, I think, are starting on their next batch now. So they've set up a new nest. I know, they've already had five and now they want more. What the hell are they about? Don't they want to have a life? but it's relatively quiet here. I'm heading north on the canal, heading up towards Sawbridgeworth. I'm at a place that's it's all right. It's nice and quiet. There's a couple of trucks outside. There's one outside today with a beep, 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 which was really annoying. Little aircraft tend to use the canal to find their way into London. So every so often I have to stop recording because a little crappy aircraft will fly past. But apart from that, it's all right here. It's not too bad. Update at the moment. I've been on a diet for the last couple of weeks because I've been getting quite fat, quite round, quite portly. When I sit on the bed, I feel like a panda. So about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I popped myself on a diet, proper diet, not one of these crappy diets that, like Jennifer Aniston says, oh, you've got to go on my diet and you can eat just chicken and it makes your breath stink like a mortuary. I don't think it's good to kind of look nice but stink. I think it's best to have the best of both worlds. And also, you shouldn't just eat protein. You should have a balanced diet. So I've been changed my diet. I've cut out all of the things that we know we're not meant to eat, like bread, dairy, and refined sugar, things like that. So fruit for breakfast, vegetables for lunch, and then fish, rice and vegetables in the evening. And then I give myself a nice, in the evening, I pop on a podcast, not true crime, I've kind of gone off true crime. And I pop on a nice podcast, some storytelling, and I go off on a nice 2-hour walk. And it's, yeah, I've really lost a lot of bulk. There's a lot of bulk and a lot of wibble wobble. Before, when I walked, there would be wibbly wobbly. But now, there's very little wibbly wobbly. So I'm slowly letting, on Sundays, don't get me wrong, I do have fun on Sundays. Sundays is kind of beers and some ice cream and some chocolate and last weekend, oh dear, I decided to make some cheese and ham sandwiches because even though I'm a vegetarian, my body said, you need this. And I have a thing called chromium deficiency, so my body can't regulate minerals properly. So when I get weak, my body goes, it tells me what I need to eat. It forces it into my head and I can't concentrate. And sometimes it goes marzipan and there's nothing I can do about it. I can't work, I can't concentrate, I have to go and get some marzipan. Or sometimes it's ham and cheese tagliatelle. Last week, because I hadn't had any wheat, I hadn't had any meat, hadn't had any cheese, I needed cheese and ham sandwiches. So I made some cheese and ham sandwiches. I made 6, which were far too many. And then I spent the whole night lying in bed grumbling because I couldn't move. I was hurting from eating too much food because my body's not used to eating big meals anymore. But it's working. It's working. I'm shifting bulk, which is good. So normally in this section, what I would do is do listeners' questions. And I put some in last week. That was great. Obviously, you haven't heard the new episodes yet. And at the end of that, I do the listeners' questions, and I asked you for any questions at all. Obviously, that episode hasn't gone out yet as I record this. But if you do have any... I got burps again. Oh, dear. If you do have questions, message me. Just send them in. Any questions about any episode, about how Murder Mile is made, how it's researched. You can dive into any episode and ask me any question. As a listener very recently... I do apologise, I've forgotten who you were. But on my Murder Mile True Crime Podcast discussion group, asked a very fantastic question and said... The good thing is it's on my phone, so I could probably check it on my phone. No, I won't do that. It was... Chetty said, with the Blackout Ripper story, she's listening to the Blackout Ripper story, and... So it's Deutsch June, so it's technically his last victim. Oh, here we go. Okay, it was Kim Nixon. Fantastic, Kim. Okay, hi everyone. I have a question about the Blackout Ripper. See, it makes more sense if I read it. After leaving Greta Haywood and Kathleen Mulcahy, he went round the corner to meet Deutsch June. But how did that meeting happen? Did they just meet in the street by chance? Or was Deutsch looking for business, inverted commas? Or did he see her by going by her house and follow her? Which is a fantastic question. Thanks for that, Kim. That's one of those questions that's interesting because we never saw the Blackout Ripper meet any of his victims. It's because he was in a military uniform, he just blended in. If he was a man who was a clown, let's say he worked for the circus, you'd spot a clown going through Soho. But because he was in an RAF uniform, and most men were in military uniforms, he blended in. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of men in the West End all dressed identical. And don't forget, the fashion was very similar, so the haircuts would be the same, they'd be about the same height. You wouldn't have an airman who was fat or had a walking stick, or, do you know, they were all... factory built, essentially. They're all of a type. So we never saw the Blackout Ripper meeting any of his victims at all. We had details of seeing him in various places by different prostitutes who'd seen him, but that is it. So on that final night, the Blackout Ripper was in Piccadilly. He attempted to strangle Greta Haywood. He failed. He dropped his gas mask. He ran away. He picked up Kathleen Mulcahy on Regent Street and then got in a cab with her to go to... See, it's gone out of my head already. A street by Sussex Gardens where Deutsch June lived. He attempted to attack Greta Haywood again. That failed. He escaped. He walked in the direction of Sussex Gardens, and that's where it ends. That's where we can't see where the Blackout Ripper went. And also because Deutsch June was in Piccadilly going to meet the captain, inverted commas, of which we know nothing about, and the date didn't seem to happen because she ended up back home within an hour. We've no idea how she got from Piccadilly back home. She may have got a taxi, she may have walked. We have no idea how the two of them met. We would love to know, but Deutsch June is dead. And the Blackout Ripper is also dead as well. So, fantastic question, but unfortunately one of those that we just can't give an answer to. And hence, in the Blackout Ripper episode, I deliberately leave that blank. There's no meeting, there's no point where we kind of see them come together. But that's the problem with murder history. sometimes, as with the Brian Alexander Robinson episode, sometimes there's not a lot of information. Sometimes the information you have is incorrect. So you have to pity sometimes the police in their job when people go, oh, I don't see why the police couldn't, you know, find out who the murderer was. It's clear. In hindsight, it's clear. If I look at like the Brian Alexander Robinson story now, yeah, of course, I know who the murderer is. I know that Brian murdered Johnny accidentally with a knife, and I know where the knife was. But the police, they've got 20 to 30 different people giving different witness statements. Actually, in the story, when they went back to Brian's house, I cut this out for time because it slowed it down. But Brian had actually washed it. This is something that's confusing. So it's said that Brian stabbed Johnny. He then went back into the club, which doesn't make sense. He took off his bloodied shirt, which had Johnny's blood on it, with the knife. He got the knife, he wrapped the knife in his shirt, put it inside his jacket. Then he got into a cab and then he drove home. And then he went into his front garden, which is technically not his front garden because he's on the first floor. So it'd be the person on the ground floor, their garden. And he washed the knife and then he buried it in the back garden. And then when the police turned up, he denied all knowledge of the murder. And then a very astute policeman found a bit of soil that had been, not ruffled. Soil. What am I saying? Soil. See, I could edit this in. I can't remember. I can't do that, can I? Soil that looked like it'd been disturbed. Thank you, Michael. That's the word I wanted. There was some disturbed soil. He dug it up, and about a couple of inches down, he found the knife. And they walked in, and the police inspector said to Johnny, we're questioning you in relation to the murder of a white man. He said those words. A white man in Darblay Street last night, of which Brian said, I know nothing about that. And then he said, he showed him the knife and he said, is this your knife? And he said, no, I have no idea whose knife that is. He denied that he'd buried it, although later on he retracted his statement and admitted that it was his knife. He did put it there. But it just slows down the story. I couldn't think of a way of telling it properly without thinking, why are we doing this? Do you know, sometimes some scenes in a story can really slow the story down. So I decided not to do that with this one. Cool. Okay, so that was the murder of Brian Alexander Robinson. Hope you enjoyed that. More to come. More murders. These are all going nicely. I think I'm going to aim for about 2024-ish. If you know of any in the West End, because obviously I've expanded slightly. I've got my Soho area. I've got my Paddington area. I've got my King's Cross Euston area. So all interestingly, because the Blackout Ripper moved, I've kind of picked some of those areas as well. And I've picked Euston and King's Cross because I will be going back to... Remember the Dutch Lair story? That's part of a thing called the Soho Strangler. So I'll probably be doing a multi-part series about the Soho Strangler. Hopefully, if I can get more information on that. But that is based in Euston and King's Cross. But a lot of murders seem to happen around train stations. It seems to be a very transient area. Soho is a transient area. People tend not to live there for very long. It tends to be transient. Tends to be people who are looking for prostitution and drugs. Hence, there's a lot of prostitution stories. But also, it's the same with Paddington and Euston and King's Cross. So that's why I've picked those areas as well. But if you have any stories that you know of that happened in those areas, get in touch. I'm happy to look at them. I'm happy to dive in. They don't need to be murderous stuff. It can be manslaughter. It can just something that's interesting. Things that just are intriguing, I find more interesting than... I'm not really that bothered about stories to do with people getting their heads cut off and bodies boiled in acid. It's like, it's fine, but it's kind of like, It's easy to tell a story about someone, about all these grisly details, whereas it's harder to tell a story that's interesting about a person's life, about how they ended up in that situation. How many times have you listened to stories about Ted Bundy and not heard anything about the victims? Not heard anything about their life? All you hear about is Ted Bundy met this person on this date and they ended up in this barrel or head in a fridge. I think it's better to tell a personal story, real story, life story. That's what we're here for in life. It's a life story. It's not. Can you imagine if your life was summed up in just a couple of words? Or your life was summed up by your death? How depressing would that be? It's like, here is Michael. He was hit by a bus. His head was squashed under the front left wheel. I don't think I'd like that. I think I'd like people to remember me as podcaster, writer, podcaster, true crime podcaster. Maybe some people might remember me for my awful plays I wrote years ago that no one came to see. But you'd want to be remembered for something better than just being a collection of injuries. Anyway, that was episode 2 of season 2 of Murder Mile. Thank you so much for listening. New episode next week, and I'm going to sign off now. Of course, I always forget how to sign off. I can't remember. Please do, if you can work out how to get me to sign off properly. A catchphrase or something like that. I don't know, because I've no idea. Look, I'm waffling now. I'm going to sign off. So after 3, we'll blow each other a kiss. Okay? Ugh. Right. Or you can just wave. So after 3. 1, 2, 3. Bye. Mwah. Wave.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.